Hi, Rosa.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
Good. We've never actually spoken until this phone call.
No, in fact, I don't have any evidence that you really exist.
Very few people do, and I like to keep it that way.
But it's an honor to be talking to the original head of Blogging Heads.
Oh, gosh. I'll bet you say that to all the media pioneers.
Well, I don't know very many.
Yeah, well, I'm not one of them anyway. But, you know, we may be related. Did you know that my mother's maiden name is Brooks?
Very unlikely that we're related, however.
Wait, why do you say that?
There are lots of Brookses. In fact, I selected my husband based on his possessing an extremely common last name with no particular discernible ethnic identity.
So this comes from your husband, this name?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Did his family ever spend much time in Arkansas or West Texas?
No.
Oh.
No.
Well, that does diminish the odds.
It does diminish the odds. I get a lot of confusion about my name. Half the people think I must be an ethnic Brooks, whatever the ethnic Brookses are, and the other half assume that I'm Hispanic because my name is Rosa.
Well, are the ethnic Brookses Jewish?
Some of the ethnic Brooks are Jews, and some of the ethnic Brooks are boring Anglo-Saxons, and I think it's a whole mix.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm glad we straightened that out. I don't know where, what I may be ethnic, who knows?
You may be ethnic. We are all ethnic.
In some sense or another.
From some perspective, yes.
But my family history is lost in the midst of third generation illiteracy or something, and I still don't know. I could be ethnic.
Hmm.
So anyway, we were going to talk about a number of things. You know, first I wanted to ask you a little about this blog that you contribute to sometimes, Democracy Arsenal.
Yes. Yes,
I guess
yes.
Is that in a long haul been your main outlet aside from the LA Times column?
I'm having trouble hearing you, Bob.
Oh, I was saying, has Democracy Arsenal been the main outlet for your writing aside from the Los Angeles Times column?
Well, my main official outlet for my writing, since my day job, I'm a law professor, is actually even worse. It's not blogging at all. It's writing things in law reviews and stuff.
Ooh.
I know. It's terrible, let me tell you. But I've been doing a little bit of blogging on the side. I barely qualify as a blogging head. I do have a head, but I hardly blog, although I aspire to get better. But yes, from time to time, I do manage to put together a couple paragraphs for Democracy Arsenal, which is a great blog, perhaps because of my usual non-participation.
It really is a good blog. It's one of these multi-author blogs, one of these group blogs. And I guess you would say that, broadly speaking, it's a foreign policy blog done basically by Democrats, right, with a capital D?
We define ourselves without actually defining it, of course,
in
as
partisan
progressives. Because everybody, as you know better than I, everybody starts to have little fist fights when you try to decide whether to call yourself a Democrat or a progressive or God knows what. We have decided that we're untheoretical and we're just going to go with progressives because it sounds nice.
Okay.
But I would say that we're all Democrats. That's fair.
Okay, but certainly more left than right.
Yeah, the blog is actually at this point formerly hosted by the National Security Network, which is itself is nonpartisan.
Right.
So we happen to be Democrats.
Right.
But we welcome progressive Republicans, if that's completely clear.
Yeah, well, in fact, yeah. I think the head of the National Security Network has something of a Republican past. Is that right?
Randy Beers?
Yeah.
My goodness, I'll interrogate him about that.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, it's certainly true that Randy has been a career public servant.
Right.
And he has served under Republican and Democratic administrations throughout his career.
I could be wrong.
And it's... I certainly think that one of the things that we see ourselves as trying to do with the blog, maybe not so successfully, it's obviously not for us to evaluate that, but is actually trying to find a way to talk about foreign policy issues in a way that gets it outside of a narrow partisan framework.
Mm-hmm. No, there definitely is a diversity of voices. And, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you about is, when I read a blog like that, I kind of try to get a sense of, like, which of the contributors are a little more dovish-leaning and which are more hawkish-leaning.
Right.
And I'm having trouble decoding people in that regard, especially in the Democratic Party, kind of. And I'll tell you why. The reason is on the one hand, you know, a famous political vulnerability of Democrats is that people think that they're not, you know, tough enough on national security. So on the one hand, you get all these people kind of trying to talk tough, whether or not they're very hawkish.
Right.
On the other hand, meanwhile, in the wake of the Iraq War, true hawks are kind of held in disrepute in the Democratic Party and perhaps increasingly elsewhere because they helped get us into this war, which didn't work out well. And so you have true hawks kind of playing down their their hawkish side, and they say, you know, of course, bombing Iran is the last thing on my mind, but you kind of wonder, right?
Right.
And so how is a person supposed to tell, if you look at, like, all of the potential advisors of presidential candidates on the Democratic side, how am I supposed to figure out who the hawks are? That's my question.
Well, my answer to that would be, if you have to try to figure that out, then your whole framework is screwed up. Not you personally. But part of what we're trying to do with the National Security Network more broadly, and Democracy Arsenal as an offshoot of that, is precisely to say the whole hawk-dove framework, you know, the whole idea that we've got these two opposing sides, there are hawks and there are doves, and hawks like to use military force and they think it's a good idea, and doves hate it because they're a bunch of wussy wimps, you know, as compared to the brutal thuggish hawk types. You know, that's a really flawed way to understand the world if you see those as the only two options. And part of this, I actually
wait, what if you see them as tendencies? It is a fact, is it not, that people who favored the Iraq War are more likely to favor military action in Iran than people who did not, right? There are patterns of thought here.
There are definitely patterns of thought, but I think that part of what we're trying to do is break out of those patterns and try to get people to realize that those are really rotten, stupid, destructive patterns to be locked into. You know, I think that to the extent that you can say that those of us who are blogging at Democracy Arsenal and part of the National Security Network have something in common, because there is a lot of diversity within the group, it's precisely a commitment to saying, you know, let's break away from those patterns. We all have to understand that, sure, there is a time and a place for military power, but ideally, you're not using it, and you're using the full range of American government tools, diplomacy, intelligence, public diplomacy, you name it, you know, and that's often much more effective at achieving your quote-unquote hard security interests than military power actually is. And that doesn't mean that we don't, you know, people still won't disagree on the specific situations in which you should use military force, but just precisely trying to reject that whole framework and think much more in terms of using the full range of tools that we have rather than an either-or military force, not military force, is part of what I think we're trying to do.
Yeah, although I would say two things. One is, I don't know of anybody who would not subscribe to what you just said, which is use your full range of diplomatic... John Bolton would say use your full range of diplomatic tools. And so, you know, I'm not sure that's...
Yeah, and what we're trying to do, you know, I don't... Democracy Arsenal is a blog. You know, Democracy Arsenal is not trying to lay out a coherent vision of anything. Democracy Arsenal is a bunch of individuals who are reacting in a pretty ad hoc and uncoordinated way to events as they come up.
Right.
But certainly what the parent organization, National Security Network, that's hosting it, is trying to do is to come up with a much more coherent set of principles for evaluating, well, when exactly is appropriate use force, when is it not, both in the abstract and in terms of the specific challenges that we're facing.
Right.
So, you know, you're right. I mean, easy to say, harder to do in practice, but I think that, as you said, you know, there are patterns that emerge in practice. I think that the patterns that tend to emerge for this group of people break the usual pattern, if that makes any sense.
I'm not convinced yet, but maybe someday I will be. I guess the question about hawks and doves, I mean, ultimately, when you have, when the question comes as to whether you invade, it is a binary question, and there are people who favor it and people who oppose it.
What is a binary question? Depends how you frame the question.
Invading any given country.
but at the time you get to that question, you've already made so many other decisions. If you get to the binary question, you've probably already screwed up, right?
Well, no, but I mean, we were at that point with Iraq. Mm-hmm. You always have the option of invading every country. You always face that binary question with respect to all countries. We can invade Canada tomorrow.
Right.
Fortunately, most of us oppose it. But
well, if the framework is what would my general stance be towards the invasion of other countries as an abstract matter, other countries defined to include, you know, Iraq, Canada, and Liechtenstein, I would say that I would come out on the dovish side of that overall equation.
Yeah. There is a genuine concern here, which is, I'm trying to, you know, if I'm sitting around thinking which potential advisors within the Democratic Party do I want to acquire influence, you know?
Right.
Which of them do I want Barack Obama or whoever to choose? There's a very concrete question I have.
Okay.
Which is that if we're, in an Iraq war-like situation, are they going to want to invade or not? Because many, many Democrats did, and it was a bad idea.
Right.
And that means more to me than whether they'll say that we should use all them diplomatic tools, because, you know, every human in America will say that.
Yeah. But I can't help you with that problem, Bob, because what you're talking about is a different issue. You're not talking about a philosophical stance. You're talking about cowardice and lack of backbone. I mean, that was the problem there. You know, no amount of pre-commitment to a bunch of philosophical principles or political principles or political science principles is going to save you if you just wimp out because you're terrified of what the polls say and it's shortly after 9/11 and you want to look macho. Nothing's going to save you.
Yeah, that's probably true. So you mean lack of backbone being not too cowardly to invade a country, but being too cowardly to resist the tide of public opinion favoring.
Yeah. No, I think that was an example of bad faith on the part of lots and lots of people, you know, including Hillary Clinton, including John Edwards, people who should have known better and in fact did know better. Including John Kerry. I mean, that's one of the things that have, of course, recently come out, is that, you know, Kerry thought he should vote against it. He should have voted against it, but he let himself be talked out of voting against it because he thought he couldn't afford politically to vote against it. And it was that sort of mass cowardice on the part of the Democratic Party, that's led it to the state it's in now, just looking like they're all over the place.
Yeah, so actually I've never... I actually don't know the answer to this question, but I'm starting to infer that you actually opposed the war before it happened.
Me?
You.
You know, I was more ambivalent than many of my friends on the left. I'm sort of actually glad that I wasn't in the Senate, although I hope if I had been in the Senate, I would have had more information than as a citizen I have. You know, my position was, this is almost certainly going to be a complete disaster. There is a tiny possibility that there really are WMD. If that is in fact the case, then this is the right thing. I can't evaluate it because I don't have access to the intelligence. I have a feeling that this is doomed and we probably shouldn't do it, but I don't know. I was actually more wishy-washy and ambivalent than a lot of my friends were. And I've looked back on that a lot and wondered why I was even as willing as I was to think, well, maybe they have intelligence that I just don't know about. And I think it's because I had only recently come from working in the government. I'd been at the State Department for a while during the Clinton administration. And you can say all kinds of bad things about the Clinton administration, many of which will be justified. But I don't think you saw the kind, you know, you didn't see the kind, or at least the scale, of deliberate monkeying with the data and the actual facts that you saw in the Bush administration. So I think I was approaching it from a sort of a false framework of, well, they wouldn't actually make stuff up, would they? And now of course, it turns out that, yes, they would. So.
Well, I'm not sure they made... I thought of it as kind of mass self-delusion. But see...
I think they were making stuff up.
But see, to me, I mean, I assumed they were right, and it still seemed to me that as long as we had the inspectors in there being allowed to look anywhere they wanted, I didn't see the point of the war. I mean, especially given the fact that nobody was claiming they actually had nuclear weapons already. Nobody was claiming they had a biological weapon that is actually contagious that we don't have a vaccine for. So there was no, there was no imminent threat. And in a way, I guess it kind of bothers me.
Oh, no, you're right. Let me give myself a little bit more credit. I take back what I just said. I was not ambivalent about the timing. That's right. Sorry. I want to give myself more credit. I had forgotten about the fact that my position was we may eventually need to go to war, conceivably, but
not now.
Not right now. We sure need to give the inspections more time. You're right. Rosa, you weren't so dumb after all. Okay.
Well, I'm glad we got that out of the table.
I'm glad I remember that.
It was probably only weeks.
Somewhere I was saying to myself, Rosa, what's wrong with you, you craven fool.
That counts as opposing the war. The question is, on the eve of the war...
I did.
That counts. You're in good shape. I'm glad you got that. Gosh, I should charge you a fee for that.
You should.
Because if we had waited another few weeks, that memory might have vanished forever.
I would have been doomed. It would have completely screwed my future political career when I run for president.
Okay. So now you can be Secretary of State, assuming we can find a way to send all of your L.A. Times columns through the paper shredder.
Oh, yes. That's a slight problem.
And so we can move on to talk about other things, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
We were going to talk about Scooter Libby a little, I guess.
Yeah, poor old Scooter. I don't have a whole lot to say. I feel kind of sorry for the guy. Not that I think he shouldn't go to jail, but I do feel kind of sorry.
You do feel sorry. Were you among those who wrote letters on his behalf?
Well, I drafted a very heartfelt and moving letter testifying to, you know, Scooter's deep patriotism and testifying to the fact that America will be the poorer if we cannot have any more fiction by Scooter, and that I hope that at least in prison he will be given access to a word processor.
Well, I can't see you, so I can't judge for sure, but I'm pretty sure you're joking.
I'm totally in favor of public servants writing lurid purple prose. I would like to see Scooter do more of it.
Yeah. Well, he will have time, I guess, unless that tide of letters in his favor, which was written by, I guess, a diversity, right?
Not a great diversity, however.
Well, not a great diversity.
We had a handful of sort of token non-Republican attack dogs, but largely it was the inner circle.
Yes, and I think any liberals were liberals who had supported the war. I think there were no Rosa Brookses in there.
No. People
who clearly did not support the war.
It was touching to see people like Doug Fife weighing in on, you know, commitment to the rule of law and justice and integrity and rights and so forth.
What did Fife say that he couldn't have inflicted Abu Ghraib on the world had it not been for Scooter Libby's heartfelt support?
Right. Exactly. But where was the letter from Dick Cheney?
Well,
where was Dick? Too busy to write.
He was lobbying for the pardon that's, you know, months down the pike.
Yeah, I sure hope he is, if I were Scooter.
I don't know how to predict these things. A lot of people think a pardon is in the works.
Yeah, on some level, I feel okay. Now I'm going to say another thing that I probably shouldn't say. I almost feel like the poor guy ought to get pardoned, because he was so clearly a fall guy. You know, if there's anybody who goes to jail, you know, it so clearly ought to be his boss, basically. And watching Scooter twist in the wind almost makes me want to see the poor guy pardoned. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't. It's just because I thought his novel was so bad that it was good. So
Did you read the actual novel?
Yeah, I did. I did. It was a while ago.
You've got too much time on your hands, Rosa.
What? I'm sorry, Bob.
You've got too much time on your hands, I said.
I do have too much time on my hands. So, yeah, I've been feeling sorry for Scooter. And you know, here, this is my kind of theological view of pardons, right? Pardon is a pardon. A pardon doesn't mean you're not guilty. Pardon is, you know, unmerited clemency.
No, in fact, you usually express remorse, I think, to get a pardon, right?
Well, he should express remorse, yeah. He should express remorse, and he should take a few people down with him. That's what I'd like to see. And then a pardon. How about that?
Yeah. But see, I do think from a, like, systemic point of view, you do have to affirm the principle that you don't lie. You don't lie to a grand jury. You don't lie when the FBI investigators come around. And, you know, I think he should go to prison. I mean, and you know, when Clinton was they were trying to pin a perjury rap on Clinton, I never made the argument that, oh, well, you know, who doesn't lie about an extramarital affair or anything? Perjury is serious. I think with Clinton there was an argument that he had been a victim of entrapment, basically. But it's serious.
You wanted Bill in prison, too.
No, I didn't lobby for that, but I wasn't making this particular excuse for him. I mean, I do think if there was an excuse to be made, it's... He literally was a victim of entrapment. I mean, they asked him questions that had no relevance to the actual investigation, only to get him to tell a lie.
Right.
I don't
actually buy that theory. Yeah, I don't buy that theory. Although it is, of course, one of the many interesting things about Scooter's 150 letters of support, letters of affection and support, is how many high officials in the Bush administration insisted that it's extremely hard for any of them to remember what they're doing at any point in time, that none of them, they all have really rotten memories. They are not detail-oriented people, and this explains quite a lot about the Iraq War, as well as many other foreign policy disasters, a whole bunch of guys who really can't keep track of what they're doing or saying when.
There was a lack of detail orientation in the follow-up to the Iraq invasion, I would say.
Yes, yes.
So,
they were too busy. That slipped their mind because they had so many pressing responsibilities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you got occupation and several other things on your list. Something's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
So, speaking of, I guess, the war on terror, you wanted to talk a little about this Gitmo thing, right? I mean,
I gather,
tell me if I've got it wrong, just from looking at the headlines, more or less. These military judges kind of surprised people by basically saying that these two Gitmo cases actually did not belong under the jurisdiction of the military court.
Right.
Because the legislation authorizing the whole process had said that it would apply to unlawful enemy combatants, and these guys said, where's the evidence or even assertion that these are unlawful enemy combatants as opposed to just enemy combatants? I guess one of them was picked up in the Afghanistan war, maybe both, I don't know. But so that was...
Yeah, well, and that's basically right. I mean, it's a little bit more technical than that. The Military Commissions Act says that the military commissions will have jurisdiction over alien unlawful enemy combatants as determined by the combatant status review tribunals, or if they've committed certain kinds of hostile acts and are not lawful combatants. So a little bit circular here. The combatant status review tribunals themselves weren't convened for the purpose of determining anything other than whether these people had been rightly detained in the first place, right? E.g., were they combatants or not,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to poor Joe Schmoes, who had been in the wrong place at the wrong time, or had been turned over by a bounty hunter or whatever. And so what the combatant status review tribunals found, in fact, a significant percentage of the detainees, they said, oh, whoops, these guys aren't even combatants. You know, they're just ordinary people. They shouldn't be here at all. Most of those folks have now been released. Not all, which is another story, but most of them have now been released. So in theory, the other people are enemy combatants, but the Combatant Status Review Tribunal wasn't determining whether or not they were unlawful. And part of the reason for that, you know, is that the term unlawful enemy combatant is a made-up term. It's fake. There's no law of war concept, unlawful enemy combatant. In fact, until the Military Commissions Act was passed, which defined the term, albeit defined it with enormous ambiguity, such that nobody still knows what it means, it was a term that had no legal meaning whatsoever. So what basically happened is that the judges said, gee, these combatant status review tribunals determined that these guys were enemy combatants, but the Military Commissions Act says that we only have jurisdiction over people who've been determined to be unlawful enemy combatants. So, you know, we don't have jurisdiction over these guys. But you know what's interesting here, and I think that it's the media has been kind of slow to pick up on, not surprisingly, because this gets so technical so fast. What's interesting here is that this is an artifact of the whole decision in the first place to treat Al-Qaeda as being part of an armed conflict with the United States and Al-Qaeda suspects as combatants. You know, the Bush administration has wanted to have it both ways. You know, the great thing, if you're a combatant, about the law of war is that you get combatant immunity. You know, if you're a combatant, you're allowed to shoot at your enemies. It's not a crime to be shooting at your enemies. And it's the whole business about whether you're wearing a uniform or not is kind of a red herring. That's relevant to whether you qualify as a POW, not whether you qualify as a combatant who is permitted under the laws of war to be trying to kill your enemies. So the problem for the Bush administration is now they want to have it both ways. You know, they want to simultaneously say we're in a war against terror, and Al-Qaeda, suspected members of Al-Qaeda are combatants, but we also want to be able to put them on trial if they kill American troops.
Mm.
And you sort of can't have it both ways. You know, there are some circumstances you can. I mean, if they you know, shot in the back of the head a wounded American who laid down his arms, it would be a war crime. You know, you don't get combatant immunity for war crimes. But that's kind of the situation they're now in, is basically, you know, these guys, the one Khadr, Omar Khadr, the one who was 15 years old when he was detained, he's now 20, you know, he's charged with crimes relating to having thrown a grenade that killed an American soldier. Well, he could be an enemy combatant, but if he threw a grenade at an American soldier while in a battle with the U.S., that's probably not against the law.
And it was in Afghanistan?
I believe so.
Yeah, I mean, after all, that's the country we invaded, and it doesn't matter how just the invasion was, right?
Right.
I mean, we eventually, you know, wound up fighting in Germany in World War II,
right.
And I'm sure there's a lot of German troops that killed our soldiers, and I'm sure our you know, incursion in Germany was just, but it wasn't considered a war crime for them.
Well, and it's the whole, we could have decided to say that was an armed conflict. It very clearly was an armed conflict in Afghanistan. But we could have said that people like Omar Khadr, age 15, sympathizer with al-Qaeda, is a civilian, you know. And that doesn't mean that we can't try him if he violates the laws of war. If he takes up arms, you know, he waives his rights to be given certain protections civilians get. You know, but the Bush administration was so determined to treat every person who attempted any hostile act against the U.S. as a combatant in a war that they've now boxed themselves into this corner where some of the very things that we want to go after these guys for are precisely the things that if we define them as combatants, it's not really clear we can go after them for it.
Okay, so from Bush's point of view, what exact legal... Mm-hmm. Function was filled by calling them combatants? I mean, I know rhetorically they wanted to depict the whole thing as a war, but you're...
I think legally it's been really damaging. I mean, the only thing that they gain out of it, sort of, maybe, would be that you can detain people indefinitely without charging them if they're combatants.
Mm.
But I think that, you know, as we've already seen, the unintended consequences of that in terms of making even more enemies of the U.S. have been so great that I think clearly in hindsight it's been a disaster. And one of the many ironies here, you know, the whole theory behind treating them as combatants and trying them before military commissions was that the civilian court system wasn't going to be, you know, capable of adjudicating these really nefarious terrorists cases. And, you know, well, actually, two ironies. You know, one of the ironies is that most of the people who have gone before the military commission so far, it's been total small fry. You know, David Hicks, who pleads guilty, gets 9 months, the Australian guy. Khadr, who was 15 years old, we're scared of a 15-year-old. He's the worst of the worst. You know, one irony is that it's the small fry who are going before the military commissions, not the worst of the worst. And the other is that, meanwhile, you know, the civilian court system has actually been doing an excellent job of trying and convicting and locking up al-Qaeda suspects like Richard Reid and Zacharias Moussaoui, you know.
Yeah.
You compare the two systems, and it sure looks like one, not that it's perfect by any means, but the civilian system, for all of its flaws, has pretty effectively, you know, tried and locked up some very nasty guys, while the military commission system just can't seem to get it together.
Well, of course, that's partly because I assume if there is a really clear-cut case for prosecution, we give them to the civilian courts, right? I mean,
No.
That's not the case?
If only. That would make too much sense, Bob.
That's why I'm not president.
Right. No, I mean, that would make it true. That's what we should be doing, quite clearly. You know, Guantanamo, as a symbol, has been a disaster. It should be closed, if only for that reason. The detainees who are currently there, those of them who do not pose any serious danger to the U.S. should be sent back home or released. And the relatively small percentage who have committed serious crimes against the U.S. or conspired to commit serious crimes should be put on trial in civilian courts. And most of them can probably be convicted. But the Bush administration just will not back away from this original very stupid decision that we have to treat all these people as combatants and try them in military commissions.
But it seems it must be the case that they thought themselves that they had a weak case in some, right? In order, I mean, why did they want to go the military court route?
Two reasons. Well, two reasons. One, I think it was simple chest beating. You know, Bush liked the idea of being a war president, et cetera, et cetera. The order of November 2001 creating the military commissions was referred to by the White House as a military order. I'm not sure that that... I could be wrong about this, but I don't think there's any precedent for a president issuing an executive order, what we usually call an executive order, and just deciding to call it a military order. So I think part of it had to do just with wanting to look tough, and the word military sounds kind of tough, whereas the word executive sounds kind of technocratic, right? So part of it, I think, is just that, and the other part of it is that I think we now have reason to believe that they knew at the time that they intended to treat these people in illegal ways, e.g. torturing them and using other coercive interrogation techniques that would, in fact, make it harder to try them in a civilian court, which would rightly bar evidence obtained through torture.
Hmm.
You know, I think that's the bottom line.
I see.
They wanted a system in which they would be able to use evidence obtained through torture.
So the fact is that actually at this point, there are a lot of people that they would have to let go who may in fact have committed crimes.
Well, that's a good question, and we don't know because so much is still murky and unknown about the status of both the Guantanamo detainees and the detainees held at so-called black sites, and actually a group of human rights organizations just today released a list of about 35 names of individuals who've been ghost detainees, you know, held incommunicado, hidden from the Red Cross at black CIA sites around the world, and we really don't know much about those folks. But even at Guantanamo, I mean, on the one hand, there is a lot we don't know. But I actually think that the majority of the people in Guantanamo aren't all that dangerous, frankly. You know, they're foot soldiers. You know, yeah, if we let them go, they might go back and join the Taliban again, but this doesn't really differentiate them from, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who we haven't detained and who we wouldn't bother to detain because they can't do us that much harm.
That's probably true, but I suspect that if your explanation was valid, that in some cases...
Right. Yeah.
They use torture.
Yes.
I assume that they probably used it in the cases that they considered the most grave.
No,
so it may well be
true that
there are these people who did serious things or would be inclined to do serious things who we would have to let go. And the reason I want to establish that is because I think it's kind of... there's too much dancing around. I mean, liberals do too much dancing around kind of difficult messages to send.
Let me
just say what I think is a difficult but true message to send. Yes, if we let these people go, some of them may damage American interests. They may kill Americans.
Right.
Still, if you look at the probabilities and how many Americans are likely to kill and so on, it is still better for American national security to let them go and take that risk. And that's life, and life is hard.
Right.
And I think, I would like to see a Democratic presidential candidate deliver a message that's difficult to receive on the foreign policy front, because I think there are several that need to be sent that aren't trivially easy to assimilate. And that's a good example.
And nobody wants to say that because, you know, nobody wants to have the Willie Horton moment where they sound like they're for the release of dangerous criminals who are going to kill Americans. But you're right. But, Bob, I still think that there are two slightly different issues here. Yeah, I absolutely agree with what you just said. There's a category of detainees who probably did do something hostile to the United States, e.g., they were in the Taliban or they were loosely affiliated with an al-Qaeda network in some way that we don't know about. And if we let them go, especially after 5 years at Guantanamo, they are going to be sufficiently pissed off at us that they are going to seek out.
Well, even the innocent, I would think especially the innocent ones are dangerous.
Indeed,
if you're innocent and they lock you up for 5 years, you're going to be really pissed off.
And it is absolutely true that there may be people who, if we let go, are going to go and do their darndest to go and kill some more Americans. And we have to weigh whether if we have evidence that we can use in a civilian court to put these people in prison, then we should do that, frankly. You know, nobody has any interest in letting people go if they've committed crimes, right? If we don't have that, if it's just a hunch, if, as you say, right, if they're innocent but now really angry at us, well, you know, then we have to weigh, even aside from sort of the human rights argument about not detaining people based on abstract future dangerousness as opposed to something they've actually done to merit detention, there's just the pragmatic consideration of, okay, if we let this guy go, we've got one guy who may go join the Taliban. If we don't let this guy go, we may have five guys
right.
who feel motivated to join the Taliban because they're so angry at the U.S. But I think you actually were hinting at an even more difficult issue, which is what about people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who aren't small fry, right? You know, he's not just some guy who could go become a foot soldier, right? He's you know, terrorist mastermind, or let's say for the sake of the argument that he is, as he claims to be, a terrorist mastermind who has been actively involved in multiple plots aimed at killing lots and lots and lots of people and has indeed succeeded in pulling off plots that have killed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. Well, if I think you were alluding to the problem, well, what if it turns out that all the evidence against him was obtained by torturing him, so much so that if you put him in a civilian trial, you couldn't go after him? And I think that, first of all, that for the most part, with the really, the genuine worst of the worst, and there are a few of them at Guantanamo, really, really nasty terrorist mastermind types, for the most part, we have enough corroborating evidence that we would not have to rely on evidence obtained unlawfully in order to convict them in a civilian court. But I think that the tough issue that nobody does want to touch is, and maybe if we're lucky it's a hypothetical issue, is, well, what if it turns out that there are a tiny percentage of these guys who really are the worst of the worst, but the solid evidence was illegally obtained? What do you do with them? You know, how do you justify holding them? And there, I think there's some hard conversations that nobody's yet had about under what circumstances can you indefinitely detain somebody? What levels of review do you have to have built in? What other options do you have to build in? Nobody wants to have that conversation.
Oh, I'll have it. You let them go. How's that?
Do you let him go?
Yeah, I think so.
Even if it's Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
Well, I mean, what legal system are you using to justify, I mean, you know, under what system are you going to do anything other than let him go? I mean, you're a legal scholar. Maybe there is a legal regime under which you could detain him, but...
Well, here's the hypothetical question, right, that just to play devil's advocate, we commit people civilly in this country based on likelihood that they'll be a danger to themselves or others. We hold immigration detainees for extremely lengthy periods of time for the simple reason that they may have committed a crime in the U.S., but we have nowhere else to send them. So we detain them for years pending deportation. And the Supreme Court has held on that you can't necessarily detain them forever, but that basically you can detain them for a pretty long time provided you have, you know, every 6 months or something, I think it is, you know, an ongoing review of dangerousness, with the goal being that if they're not posing a threat, you would let them go at some point. And the same is true of civil commitment, right? You know, that you don't just get to slam the door and throw away the key if you determine that somebody is a danger himself or others. You know, you have to have ongoing hearings. But if the hearings are fair, A, and B, keep concluding that the person is dangerous, you do get to keep them pretty much forever.
Well, okay, if there is some legitimate legal regime under which you can detain him, that's a separate matter. But if it's the case that the only evidence you have against him, or the evidence that would be essential to prosecution, was obtained through torture, then I would say you have to throw out the case. I would also say, I mean, it's just looking at the practical aspects here. You know, this guy is a competent white-collar terrorist, capable of orchestrating terrorist plots. And there are lots of them by now, more than there were in 2001,
right.
God knows,
right.
Thanks to various things that have happened since then. There are lots of competent white-collar terrorists
right.
out there who are doing their best, who are probably as
right.
competent as him.
Right.
So far, since 2001,
right.
None of them has actually done anything catastrophic. So it can't
yeah.
be the case
yeah.
that letting one more fish back into the ocean is by itself
right.
really a great peril
yeah.
to national security. And if you compare that to the peril to national
right.
security posed by America basically disavowing everything it supposedly
forever.
Stands
yeah.
for.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, Given what propaganda value that has to terrorists, and given just how dispiriting it should be to Americans, I would say just in utilitarian terms, you're probably better off letting the guy go.
No, and I actually tend to come down the same place you do, and I think it's a conversation that should be occurring. It's a conversation that should have occurred before we started detaining people and committed to detaining them more or less indefinitely. You know, it's a conversation, I think, politically speaking, we're not likely to see it until after the next presidential election, because I think that no Democratic candidate is going to want to commit to the position you just articulated.
Yeah, no,
and that is cowardly, and it's probably totally wrong-headed, but I think that that's, you're not going to see it.
Well, yeah, well, this is a good segue. We wanted to talk about presidential candidates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm here to tell you that Al Gore is running for president.
Good.
You're happy about that?
I am, not because I'm an Al Gore supporter.
Oh, you just like competition?
Well, A, I kind of like competition, and B, it'll be really sort of, it'll be interesting to see what happens here. I have a feeling he hurts Hillary if he's in the race more than he hurts anybody else.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the reason I say this is I got an email from a friend of mine in Chicago,
right.
Dave Yellen, who went and heard him speak last night or the night before,
right.
and said he sounds like somebody who's running. And it's funny because last night I was taking a walk and listening to the audio version of the Charlie Rose show on which Gore was. And I just noticed he says, you know, I have not ruled out a run for the presidency. Well, he was not saying that 3 or 4 months ago. He was not putting it that way.
Bob, I haven't ruled out a run either.
Well, I know, but there's a difference. There's a lot of ways you can dodge the question without uttering that sentence.
Right.
That you have not, and he was always finding a way to not utter that sentence.
Right.
3 months
ago,
6 months ago, a year ago.
Right.
And I think, you know, anyway, that's my bet. I mean, I wonder, you haven't read the book, I guess, his book, have you?
No, I only read Pulp Fiction, as we
established.
That's
right, Scooter Libby books.
Yeah. Lynn Cheney's books are awesome, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you have a life well spent on your hands there, it sounds like. But you're a Barack, you're a serious Barack aficionado, right?
I sure am, yeah. Yeah.
You've called him the Messiah.
Well, only 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always on Blogging Heads.
Always on Blogging Heads. Because this is invisible, right? This stuff just
No
disappears.
One watches it, don't worry.
Nobody watches it.
And
excellent.
We burn the archives. But don't you think that probably the most formidable imaginable ticket is Gore Obama in that order?
I would personally, in terms of substance, prefer that ticket to the currently likely seeming tickets. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Wait, what's the currently likely seeming ticket?
Clinton Obama. Possibly Obama Clinton.
Well, but don't you also think it's more likely to win than the Clinton Obama ticket?
Yeah, I think almost any ticket is more likely to win than any ticket that has Clinton at the head of it. I think that at the moment, and I can't see this changing, if the Democratic ticket has Clinton at the head of it, you know, unless through some miracle, Ron Paul or Tom Tancredo becomes the Republican nominee, I think Hillary loses to pretty much everybody else.
So, but in terms of substance.
Yeah. In terms of substance, yeah, sure, I would rather see a Gore Obama ticket than a Hillary Obama ticket.
But you would rather see, in terms of substance, Obama as president than Gore?
I actually would, yes, as a matter of fact.
And why is that?
Two parts to answer that question, and one of them is actually not about substance, okay? The non-substantive one first. I think that Gore, by virtue of having, you know, been the martyr of the election of 2000, Gore, people sort of forgave him for having been such a wooden, crummy candidate. I think that if he gets back into the race, people are going to fairly promptly remember everything that they found totally maddening and off-putting about Al Gore, the candidate. So I don't think it's going to happen. And I don't think it would be a great thing. I think it would bring back all that same stuff. substantively speaking, I just think Obama is more interesting, and maybe actually, maybe this is actually a cross between substance and symbol here, but I think that part of what we need both in this country and in terms of our profile in the global community is to do something that sends a very strong signal that we are getting past the horribly divisive and alienating policies of the Bush administration and the horribly alienating and divisive fights between the Clintonites and the Bushies. And I think that Obama does that on multiple different levels, generationally speaking, ethnically speaking, because of his connections to Indonesia and to Africa, he does it. And because of the substance of his policies, he also does it in a way that Clinton can't, in a way that Gore can't, in a way that Edwards, who I basically also like a lot, unfortunately still can't. So that's sort of a mix of substance and symbol, I guess.
Yeah, no, I agree that there are a couple of objectives here, one of which is rebranding America in the eyes of the world and saying, look, we're changing channels here.
Right.
This is very different from George Bush.
Right.
I think there both Obama and Gore have pretty strong arguments. Obama is, you know, first of all, it's a black guy, right? I mean, this is really different from George Bush, you know? He's a guy who's lived around the world and so on. I mean, it just visibly sends a signal that we're changing the subject. But Gore...
We named him after Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, after all.
What's that?
We named him after Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden.
You talk about reaching out.
Yeah, as a gesture of goodwill.
Yeah.
I am still, it's been really interesting to me, by the way, just as an aside, how little traction those on the right who have tried to use that stuff have gotten. And I think a testament to Americans.
I hope that's true.
Sense.
We'll know more.
We'll
we would know.
Yeah.
We would find out more in a general election than we will in this phase about that. I mean, apparently some right-wing, you know, radio talk show hosts are making a point of using his middle name whenever they mention him, right?
Right.
But I think Al Gore does a different kind of rebranding, which is to say, look, you talk about turning back the clock and trying to repeal a mistake we made when we elected George Bush. We're going to go back and take the guy that Bush supposedly defeated, but who, in fact, got more of the popular vote. And it wouldn't be bad to remind America, to the world, that, hey, remember,
we didn't even elect
the guy.
Yeah, no, which is why I would like the Gore ticket better than I like the Clinton ticket.
Right.
But I'm not sure going back in time 8 years as a message is particularly appealing. I mean, yes, it was better than the current state, but I don't know that our aspiration should be to just roll back as opposed to say adapting.
Well, no, but I think I think Gore is pretty effective rebranding because he actually competed against Bush, and also because I think the loss of that election, or pseudo loss or whatever you want to call it, has, if anything, kind of crystallized the anti-Bush in him, right? I mean, his worldview is even more the antithesis of George Bush's than it would have been if he hadn't lost that election, I think, because of the psychological adaptation to that process.
Well, and maybe the hope would be, you know, that he's learned some lessons from that loss. And on the one hand, you know, yes, he won the popular vote. On the other hand, he didn't win it by very, very much, right? That one of the lessons he would learn is you know, he was being too careful. He was being too much of a centrist. You know, he wasn't being true to himself. And, you know, maybe if he's truly learned that lesson, it would make him a much more interesting candidate this time around than he was last time around. And he seems like he's learned it, but then again, he's not on the campaign trail yet.
Yeah, I seem more and more like it, I think. But I do think a case in terms of the merits as a president, you did allude to one very strong suit that Obama has, which is the fact that he has spent appreciable amounts of time living somewhere other than America, and more specifically in a Muslim nation. And I think, you know, the most glaring deficiency of our foreign policy has been a simple inability to even understand how things look from a non-American perspective. And I think that's not like a mushy, woolly-minded thing to say. I mean, just sound strategy dictates that you be able to understand the perspective of all players, including your enemies, anybody.
Sure.
Just be able to figure out the way things are playing outside of America. And, I mean, you know, George Bush, it's just hard to imagine somebody who is more poorly equipped for that task. And I would say there are, probably aren't many people who are better equipped than Obama, both because he's lived outside the country and because he's black.
Yeah.
I think just being black in America gives you a little help in looking at things from some perspective other than the American establishment.
Yeah.
And I think those are both great things. I guess...
What's holding you back?
What's that?
So accept him as the Messiah. What's the problem?
I guess there are a couple of doubts. Look, I have not, you know, I have not declared who I'm favoring. That's why the candidates, that's why, you know, Hillary and Gore and Obama, they're always knocking on my door.
Right.
There's this ongoing pilgrimage. They want my endorsement.
Because you were like the swing Democrat.
It's tiresome. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, could we do it by email? Please.
Be careful what you wish for.
I don't think we have to worry about this. Yeah. But, with Gore, I mean, two things. One is electability.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I mean, the people who say, you know, we're not ready for a black president, my first impulse is to say, look, people who would not vote for him because he's black are almost entirely people who would not vote for a Democrat anyway.
Right.
So I don't know about that, but there is also, you know, there is a lack of executive experience, and I think that could, that's both something to genuinely be a little concerned about, and it's something that may hurt him in the general.
Wait. What exactly is Hillary's executive experience?
I'm comparing Obama to Gore.
Okay, what is Gore's executive experience?
Well, I guess I just mean kind of experience.
I just don't quite understand why the skills and experience that you pick up as a senator or indeed as vice president, unless you're Dick Cheney, in which case you're experienced in total world domination, I don't quite understand why that experience stands you in better stead than the experience that somebody like Obama already does bring to the table.
I guess, in a way, I'm half talking about perception. I'm half talking about things that could hurt him in the general. So, in a way, it's not so much that I'm arguing with you as that I encourage you to take your case to the American people and convince them, right?
Okay.
But I do think it's an issue he has to confront.
Right.
And also, you know, I find him inspiring. I find him great. But I'm not...
Right.
I'm not totally... I don't know. I haven't seen enough of the substance, and unfortunately, a presidential campaign is really not an arena in which you're going to see much of the substance. I mean, certainly when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, yes, people may lay out a health care argument, but in terms of foreign policy...
Oh, I think we're going to see much more of that this cycle than we have in the past.
You don't think Obama and Hillary are going to be saying roughly the same things and being roughly as vague and trying to sound roughly as masculine and manly?
I think that we're going to see some significant differences between their foreign policy perspectives, and I think that we are going to see that getting mapped out. I mean, you know, God help us all. It's a very, very long campaign season. I think that I don't think they've done a whole lot of it yet. I think they've just begun to really delineate themselves. But I think that we are going to be seeing a lot more detail coming from the Obama campaign and probably from the other ones as well about foreign policy specifics as well as broad brush stuff.
Yeah, although, I mean, there's a kind of specific... This kind of gets back to the conversation we were having at the beginning.
Right.
There's a whole kind of specific thing in foreign policy that doesn't get at the question of which one actually would invade Iraq next time around, you know?
Right.
And that's something where you basically have to kind of do a lot of decoding.
Right.
And it's hard to say.
Well, and part of it is that I think that candidates are wise, not only politically, but intellectually, morally, to be, you know, not get too drawn in with easy hypotheticals. Because every situation is different, and, you know, it's not particularly obvious that it's useful to anybody to lay out some elaborate hypothetical and say, well, what would you do then? And
right.
It's not A, it's not clear that that should tell you anything except, well, assuming all of those particular facts, I would do X. But B, the hypotheticals are never fleshed out enough for you to really be able to make an informed decision about what would really be the right thing in that situation. So, I think you're right, but I also think that what you ideally want to see on some level is impossible.
Yeah, no, it won't happen. It won't happen.
Right.
You'll have to kind of, it'll be scuttlebutt. You'll have to kind of talk to people who have talked to them in private, right? And people like you, of course, you do that, actually. You're well-connected, right?
Never,
so you
no,
can tell
I'm,
me.
He's never called me. He's never called me. Brock, I'm here.
You're waiting.
Yeah, he's
but
never
you probably me. You probably know, like, Samantha Power or somebody,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I know Samantha. Damn it, Samantha, would you call me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, when she calls you, I want you to call me.
For Christ's sake, yeah.
Could we have a conference call?
We could do a conference call with Samantha. I bet we could probably accomplish that.
And then she could bring Barack on. She could patch Barack in.
She could do a three-way call with Barack.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then together we could dominate the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. That would work.
Now, do you agree that if Hillary were president, because she's a woman, there would be pressure on her to act more manly in the world, which is to say invade countries?
I would like to believe, and I almost do believe, that if she actually became president, she would be able to resist those pressures. She has not been able to resist them as a senator or as a candidate. I would like to believe, though, that once were she to find herself ensconced in the White House, that she would then be able to say, no more, I'm here. You know, I'm going to do the right thing, not the chest-beating thing, because you already voted for me. But would there be pressure? Sure, yeah.
Okay. So anyway, you are through and through Barack. I mean, you are... There's no change in your mind. You are a Barack...
Well, there's always change in my mind. I mean, we'll wait and see. At this moment in time, he's unquestionably the person who seems to me to be the most interesting and the most appealing candidate. You know, that... conceivably could change. I don't think it will, but
I totally, you know, whenever I envision it, it seems really cool, for sure, you know, to have him as president.
I did get my 2-year-old daughter has a little t-shirt with his picture on it. Says, my mom is for Obama, so I think I am committed now.
Well, that's too good to give up. I think you're, at this point, your vote is committed.
Right.
You got any thoughts on the Republican candidates at all?
My only thought about the Republican candidates is what an unsavory bunch of people they're turning out to be. It is just amazing to me if you kind of... Jon Stewart had some fun with this last night or night before, looking at their responses on gays in the military. If you kind of map out the moral terrain inhabited by the Republican candidates as a group, you discover, for instance, that nuking other countries is fine, torturing people is fine, but letting gays serve in the military is not fine. I would really like some enterprising reporter to really hone in on this question by asking them hypotheticals such as, you know, let's say you have captured a terrorist who's hidden a nuclear bomb under Manhattan, and you torture him and he confesses, but he confesses in Arabic, and the only person qualified to translate his confession revealing the location and the defusing mechanism of the bomb is a gay Arabic linguist in the military, would you accept his services? Because I think, logically speaking, they've now boxed themselves into a corner where the answer to that ought to be no, that we don't draw the line at torture or nuking people, but we do absolutely draw the line at permitting gays to assist us in ensuring our national security.
I think what they would say is, yes, let the gay do the interrogation, but afterwards you either torture the gay or nuke him.
That might be their approach.
No, actually, I think there are some fine Republicans out there. Has Ron Paul, don't you like Ron Paul?
Well, Ron Paul, I grudgingly admire Ron Paul, indeed, who does appear to be an honest man. Perhaps a crazy man on certain issues, but a consistent and principled man. Let's put it that way.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, Ross Douthat, or Douthat, depending on which is the truth, and Mark Schmidt in a dialogue earlier this week kind of hinted at this. The interesting thing is, on foreign policy, he's actually striking a note that's got to have some resonance within the Republican Party. Certainly,
oh, yeah,
as he
absolutely.
Reminds us constantly,
yeah.
Traditionally it has.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
And the question, on the other hand, he is clearly not a viable candidate. I mean, the man opposes right. Medicare, okay?
Right.
So the question is, will anybody enter, you know, like, you could imagine a kind, you know, to exploit, to occupy this niche. I mean, if it doesn't, you may find that actually Ron Paul is one of the last three or four left standing, just because he'll have it all to himself, right?
Well, no, only because of the destructive aspects of the primary system. I mean, if we had a very different kind of political system, then logically you would think that the person capable of attracting the most support across the board would be the last one left standing. But, you know, I think that the Republican base is changing, or the perceived base is changing, and at this point, you know, it may be the sort of nutball, crazy evangelical right-wingers who are the last ones standing because they have the most zealous primary voters. And they're precisely the ones least well-equipped to win the general election.
Yeah, I don't mean he'll be the last one standing, but I guess what I mean is, imagine that maybe his foreign policy line actually holds some appeal to 35% of the primary voters
right.
and holds intense appeal to, like, 15.
Right.
Well, he's got that 15 all to himself, those who would actually
right.
vote on the issue. And if you can carry 15%, you know where meanwhile all the others are dividing the base among themselves, it just seems
yeah.
to me he could last longer than people may realize.
Yeah, maybe so. And it I mean, I am not a Democratic insider, and I am, of course, even further from being a Republican insider. So I don't, God alone knows what's going on, but there clearly seem to be a lot of extremely disaffected conservative Republicans who can't understand what has happened to their party. It's been taken over by the crazies.
I mean, you meet them all the time. It's just
yeah.
maybe they only hang out in the kind of circles, you know, you and I hang out in. Who knows? But
I don't think so. I think the question is just whether they're all going to be, you know, too depressed to vote at all, or maybe they'll all just go vote for the Democrat and they won't even be voting in their own primary. Who knows? But, yeah.
My father-in-law, classic business community Republican by tradition, is not at all happy with Bush's foreign policy. I'll have to ask him how he feels about Ron Paul. I don't know.
Yeah.
But there is a niche there. Although I increasingly think Chuck Hagel is a little too flaky to do much of anything. If a more serious candidate
right.
wanted to, more serious than Ron Paul, wanted to try to take a shot, you can imagine it. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Well, or if Rudy Giuliani decided to stop faking it on the issues on which he's faking it and just get back to being old Rudy Giuliani with all of his nutsinesses, you know, maybe he could do it too. I don't know.
Well, but he can't give up on the war on terror,
right.
being the Uber hawk is
right.
his whole calling
right.
card, right?
Now that he's committed to torturing everybody, it's hard to back down.
Right, even though, you know, this all began with just him being the one person who didn't look who didn't flake out immediately
right.
after 9/11, right?
Right?
I mean, that's what his actual accomplishment was.
Right. And that's a sad thing that we're, right, giving him credit for having actually managed to remain moderately articulate and dignified.
Yeah, and just not fly around on a plane all day
right.
while his aides made up stories about how
right.
the plane had actually been subject to threats, you know,
right.
or that he had actually been subject to threats. Now, we were going to quickly, I mean, I asked you if you want to talk about immigration. You said you hadn't been paying attention. I'm the same way, and I feel we should, like, apologize for that.
Yeah,
do you?
I apologize.
Okay,
I apologize.
I guess your apology is accepted. I mean,
apologize to our nation's immigrants and to our nation's citizens for not paying enough attention to the immigration bill.
Is it your sense that just the legislation is less epically important than a lot of people seem to think, or you concede its importance, it's just the time is short and you have your particular issues?
More the latter than the former, but I also think it's probably less epically important. I think it's a placeholder. I think that depending on which party controls Congress after the next election, if this goes through, it will certainly be amended pretty significantly. If the Republicans control Congress, it'll be amended in a more punitive direction. If the Democrats control Congress, it'll be amended in a less punitive direction. But either way, 3 years from now, if this passes, we're not likely to have the same legislation be the law on the books.
So, in fact, is it not likely to pass at all within the next months? I don't know politics.
I don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah, my feeling is just, I think borders should be controlled. You should try to make immigration legal. Illegal immigration, there's a reason they call it illegal. If you can stop it, you should. But I suppose that you can imagine illegal immigration on such a scale that, yes, it would threaten things we hold dear and would be a momentous problem. I don't think we're there.
Well, that's the thing. I find the various misguided kinds of crackdowns on immigrants very, very sad.
Yeah.
Needless to say, partly because of the human cost of those crackdowns, but also because I have yet to be persuaded that we have a crisis of illegal immigration. I think that we have some serious problems in border control, in particular in sort of paying attention to who's coming through the borders, but it seems manifestly clear to me that relaxing our determination not to ever let anybody come in who we can't control in every way and approve in every way is not going to hurt us as much as we think of it. That it might actually, in a security sense, it might actually help us. And economically, I just don't see how it can hurt us. I mean, I don't know. This is not... I am not 100% certain of the ground I stand on here, but I have often wondered what actually would happen if we just said, never mind, anybody who wants to come can come. We give up. We don't care. Come if you feel like it. Come, work, whatever.
Mm-hmm. And
that's the nightmare scenario, right, for a lot of people, particularly Republicans, is, oh, my God, they just, all of Mexico moves over the border. And, this is just a thought experiment. I don't know. But I seriously doubt that anything remotely close to that would happen. I think that what we'd see initially would be an initial surge in immigration, which would then peter off to a level not much higher than what it is, frankly, partly because of the very simple reason that people do not actually like leaving their homes. They really don't like it. They like to stay where they're from. And give them the opportunity to move back and forth without huge problems, and they'll do that. They'll come here for seasonal work, they'll go back home, which is basically what they do now, only now we harass them while they do it. And the only little bit of empirical evidence I have to support my notion that this would not be the apocalyptic scenario that people imagine it is, of course, from the European Union, where before internal labor markets were freed up completely, there was lots of paranoia, that the Polish plumbers would all rush into France, and that basically that the poor, less well-educated Eastern Bloc people would come flowing into the wealthy Western European countries, sucking up social services and lowering wages. And it just didn't happen.
Hmm.
It just didn't happen. That the net migration was lower than it was expected to be, and a study done about a year ago, I think by the European Commission, concluded that the economic impact in the countries that had seen the highest rates of migration from the poorer countries in the EU had benefited economically from it.
Hmm. Well, that's relevant data. I mean, I guess I think I can imagine the mm-hmm. Illegal immigration reaching a point where it would be like a really bad thing, but in terms of whether this legislation is something that you should therefore become alarmed about, it does include a certain amount of actual tightening of border enforcement, and I guess the question is would that effect be overwhelmed by some increased incentive to immigrate that is created by the fact that there is, whether you want to call it amnesty or not, there is now hope for immigrants who are already here to acquire legal status. Mm-hmm. Illegal immigrants already here. And I just am not at all convinced that would be the case.
Yeah.
So,
no,
I Mickey Kouse, who is here every other week arguing this case, has yet to convince me, but maybe he will yet.
Yeah. Well, and here's a point that is not at all original to me, but I think worth making and repeating, the constant line that we hear, my ancestors came here illegally. Damn it! Why can't these people do the same? Well, we didn't have restrictions on immigration until relatively recently. You know, our ancestors were just lucky. Our ancestors all got here before anybody thought about passing laws trying to limit the numbers of people who could come in.
Yeah. Well, ancestry is a good note to end on, I guess. And speaking of ancestry, whether or not my mother's maiden name having been Brooks signifies that you and I are related, I hope you will get me a job in the Obama administration.
If Samantha hires me.
If she hires you, you will hire me.
I'll hire you because of our sense of kinship.
Okay, I'm on board.
All right,
I'm on board. Well, thanks a lot. This has been great.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I will talk to you soon.
All right.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.